بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين وآله محمد. For the next two or three nights I'll be dealing with one subject matter and then I'll continue with another subject matter later. There are two or three miscellaneous subject matters, inshallah, I want to cover in the next 9 or 10 nights, inshallah. There's a prophetic tradition that reads, مَا مِن مَوْلُودٍ إِلَّا يُولَدْ عَلَى الْفِطْرَةِ فَأَبَوَاهُ يُحَوِّدَانِهِ أَوْ يُنَسِّرَانِهِ أَوْ يُمَجِّسَانِهِ. That there's no newborn that is born, but that it's born based on the fitra. And then the parents make that newborn Jewish, Christian, or Zoroastrian. Now, this very important tradition has a Zahiri interpretation, a Batini interpretation, and then it also has socio-political connotations to it. And all of this, inshallah, I'll cover slowly but surely, inshallah. But first, a few preliminary points. And that is that being Jewish, being Christian, being Zoroastrian, these terms are used in opposition to the fitra. Yulad alal fitra. They're used in opposition to the fitra. So to the extent that the fitra is compromised, you become Jewish, you become Christian, you become Zoroastrian. Now, this fitra, what is it? That it's used in opposition to being Jewish, Christian, and Zoroastrian. And so this fitra is Islam. And by Islam we mean Tawheed. Pure Muhammadan Tawheed. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala. Because everything in Islam, Islamic doctrine, Islamic jurisprudence, ethics, everything is traced back to Tawheed. And everything we acquire belief in, and everything that we do, if it's done with awareness of its link and being traced back to Tawheed, we would be growing. But if it's done Tawheedlessly, you would be doing an action or having a belief, but you won't be growing because your Tawheed isn't growing. You did the action either blindly or without knowledge. But everything is traced back to Tawheed. All articles of faith are traced back to Tawheed. All prescriptions in fiqh and jurisprudence is traced back to Tawheed. Everything. This pure Tawheed is something which, first of all, it is Islam, and the fitra is based on it. And this pure Tawheed, to the degree that it's compromised, that compromise may be doctrinal in nature, it may be jurisprudential in nature, it may be ethical in nature. But to the degree, excuse me, to the degree that pure Tawheed is compromised, you become Jewish, you become Christian, you become Zoroastrian. It all depends how the compromising arises. Tomorrow I'll give you more examples on that. Which forms of doctrine, if any aberration arises within, will lead you to become Jewish or Christian or Zoroastrian. which aberrations in ethics, in jurisprudence, all these things will lead you to become Jewish, Christian, whoever you are. You may be a Muslim. That which we know is being Jewish, Christian, Zoroastrian is used in opposition to pure Tawheed. Also, according to the logic of the Holy Quran, Inna Dina Inda Allah Al Islam. Okay? So we only have one religion. Religion is only one. We don't have two religions. And in the Quran, usually Judaism, Christianity, Zoroastrianism, they're not mentioned. Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians are mentioned. But not Judaism, not Christianity. These aren't religions. Religion is one. And it's pure Tawheed, it's Islam. So if you were to define Judaism, it would be this. Judaism equals Islam plus N distortions. Those distortions may be doctrinal, ethical, jurisprudential. Christianity equals Islam plus N distortions of a different nature. And so on and so forth. So, that which Nabi Ibrahim brought was Islam. That which Nabi Musa brought was Islam. That which Nabi Isa brought was Islam. That which our Holy Messenger brought was Islam. Being Jewish or Judaism is Islam of a distorted nature. Pure Tawheed that has been distorted to some degree. That's Judaism. Or Christianity is Islam, but it's been distorted to a particular degree. Zoroastrianism is Islam, but it's been distorted to maybe more or less of a degree. Sunnism is Islam plus N distortions. The story continues, but I don't want to enter that aspect right now. So we only have Islam. It's pure Tawheed. To the degree that's distorted or compromised, you become Jewish, Christian, Zoroastrian, and so on and so forth. So it's wrong to say, it's incorrect to say that Islam complements Judaism. Islam is complementing Christianity. It's not an accurate phrase to use. Because we said Judaism, Christianity, Zoroastrianism, they are distorted forms of that pure Tawheed. Islam doesn't come to complement a distorted belief system. If you say the Islam of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has come to complement the Islam of Isa alayhi salam, that's okay. That would be correct. Religion is one. But now it's all Islam. They all came with Islam. But yes, the Islam of one can be deeper. Tawheed may manifest more because of the book of that prophet, because of the soul of that prophet, and the status of that prophet. That prophet brought Islam, like previous prophets, but the Tawheed in this prophet was manifested much more. But it was never in contradiction to the previous Islams. The preceding Islams. But it complemented the Islam of Musa and Isa and Ibrahim. But if you were to say Islam has come to complement Christianity and Judaism, you're going the wrong line, and you may inevitably see yourself as a believer in pluralism. And that would be problematic. It's all Islam. Religion is one, and it's Islam, but yes, this Islam manifests to differing degrees. In chapter 42, verse 13, شَرَعَ لَكُمْ مِنَ الدِّينِ. Allah legislated, ordained for you, min, from, ad-deen, the religion. Allah legislated for you, people, min ad-deen, from the religion. Religion is one, pure tawheed. What did he legislate? Then the verse says, مَا وَصَّى بِهِ نُوحًا. What he enjoined upon Prophet Noah. Okay? And then, وَالَّذِي أَوْحَيْنَا إِلَيْكَ. And that which we revealed to you, the Holy Messenger. وَمَا وَصَّيْنَا بِهِ إِبْرَاهِيمَ وَمُوسَى وَإِيسَى. And what we enjoined upon Prophet Ibrahim, Musa, and Isa alayhi wasalam. Look, Allah legislated for you from ad-deen. So emanating from the religion, pure tawheed, three things are mentioned. What was enjoined upon Noah alayhi salam, what we revealed to you, our Holy Messenger, and that which we enjoined upon Ibrahim, Musa, and Isa. All these three categories, there are three categories here, all of them are emanations from that ad-deen. And deen, religion, is only one, pure tawheed, Islam. But from this pure tawheed, it manifests. Noah brought Islam also, you also, the Holy Messenger, and all those prophets. But to varying degrees, but it all came from ad-deen. You see? It all came from that pure tawheed. So, to say that all religions have the same access to truth, the same access to truth, that's wrong. That's wrong. I'm not saying every Muslim is better than a Christian, or any Christian is better than a Muslim. And that's not what we're dealing with here. For now, it's a theoretical discussion. To say that all religions, that's the first problem, all religions, then do they have the same access to the truth? That's wrong. However, if you were to say that a Jew or a Christian or a Zoroastrian has access to some of the truth, 50%, 30%, 70%, that wouldn't be problematic. Because we said Judaism equals Islam, plus X distortions. But some of it is not distorted. And that degree, you have access to the truth, even if you're a Christian, even if you're a Jew. And if they're doctrinal things on a par with Islam, it'll take them to heaven. And so that would be unproblematic. They all have access to the truth. And they may act upon that access to the truth, and they would benefit from it. Sometimes you may be a Muslim though, but your doctrine or your ethics is on a par with being Jewish or Christian. And then you'll be resurrected as a Jew or a Christian, even though your passport writes that you're a Muslim. So the Zahiri understanding of this tradition is that the child that is born, it's born based on that pure fitrah and is driven to pure tawheed. But the Christian or Jewish or Zoroastrian parents makes them Jewish or Christian or Zoroastrian. That's the superficial meaning. But the esoteric meaning, the batini meaning would be this, that whoever you are, even if you're a Muslim, okay, you can make your child, you can make them a Christian. You can make them a Jew, and you can make them a Zoroastrian. Now, how that happens, I'll explain that more tomorrow. And I'll give examples of which doctrinal issues makes one's Muslim newborn a Christian over time, or a Jew over time, and so on and so forth. But this fitrah, what is it? That fitrah upon which every newborn is born. I gave the analogy of the architect, if you remember yesterday, last night. The same analogy has to be used here. That in the Quran, verse 30 of chapter 30, that's very easy to remember, 30:30, when it speaks of the divine fitrah, it says the divine fitrah allati fatara an-nasa alayha. At the divine fitrah which Allah created man based on it. That analogy of the architect, just in case some of us weren't here, was that architect has architecture in their mind, that abstract knowledge of architecture. And then manifesting from that abstract knowledge of architecture, the architect conceives of a house with certain characteristics, like, you know, the type of the bricks, the roof, the glass, the number of rooms, everything that is necessary for a good house. But they mentally conceive it. Then it comes on a piece of paper, and then it's built in the physical realm. It's a physical house eventually. Here with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, His knowledge, that is immaterial knowledge, that first manifestation of it, when it manifests in a realm commonly called Al-Amadhar. We don't want to enter that too much, but it's a semi-immaterial realm. It's a semi-immaterial realm. There, servitude and lordship, and our submission to servitude and lordship was ordained there. Like when the house with those good characteristics, the architect had mentally conceived. And then based on that semi-immaterial realm, where all people said, Bala, when he said, am I not your Lord? In the realm of Alast, Alastu Birabbikum, aren't I your Lord? And we said, yes, Qalu Bala. In that realm, here, the characteristic of servitude and submission was in everyone. Not that we existed in that realm, our physical bodies, or even our souls, but we were there in Allah's knowledge, which manifested in this way. The architect made those mental characteristics mentally, and based on those mental characteristics, built the physical house. Here, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with His divine knowledge, what emanated from that were those particular characteristics, and it appeared in a semi-immaterial form, We were there, not our souls, as we have them now, not our bodies, but we were there. And those characteristics were ordained. And then when we were to be born in the physical realm, with a physical body and a soul, it was based, Fatara Nasa, Allah created man, based on that fitra of Alastu Birabbikum. Based on that. And therefore, that that servitude and submission to Allah is within everyone, Muslim or non-Muslim. Now, how much we manifest it in this realm, that's another story. And one last point is the question of abrogation. That when you say, if you were to say Islam abrogated Judaism, that would be okay. Why? Because Judaism was a distorted form of Islam. So you can say pure Islam has come and it's abrogated Judaism, those distortions that Judaism has. Because if something abrogates something, if X abrogates Y, Y must have been imperfect. Y has a fault for it to be abrogated. But within Islam, no ruling abrogates another ruling. That would be problematic. And so abrogation, or the term nasakh, shouldn't be taken to mean that within Islam, within those 23 years, for example, one ruling came and abrogated another ruling. Because that would then mean that ruling that was abrogated was imperfect. And that's attributing a deficiency to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, what is the story of nasakh? Thank you very much. Ayatollah Jawadi Omri says, look, these are time allocated specifications. Ikhtisas azmani. Meaning, he gives the analogy of the doctor who wants to give a therapy or a regime to a patient. And for example, in treating this patient, there are three phases that the patient has to undergo. Each of the three phases are haqq, or true, have to be done. You can't go to phase two without going through phase one. After phase one, which was not faulty in any way, but they have to go through phase one before going into phase two. After phase one is finished, then phase two starts. That's not abrogating. Because when phase two starts, it doesn't mean phase one was problematic or had a fault or was imperfect. No. Everything was perfect, but it had to be done in stages. And then when phase two finishes, then you go into phase three. But each time has its own therapy. So it's okay to say Islam abrogates Judaism. That would be okay. But within Islam, for it one ruling to abrogate another, that would be problematic. Okay. And one other point is fa'abawa, one's parents, makes one Jewish or Christian or Zoroastrian. Here, ab has many different meanings. And all these different meanings have been used in the Quran. So one is parents, one is educator, one is a mentor, one is uncle, grandfather, ancestors. All these have been used, and the term ab has been used. So we don't have to confine it to parents, the school, teachers, the scholars, and even ancestors. It's possible. They can have a role, an effect, in making the newborn Jewish or Christian or Zoroastrian. We believe in spiritual genetics. Between the generations, the actions are transcended or conveyed. In the same way, in the physical realm, if parents drink, God forbid, and smoke, and then the child is born without limbs, this is cause and effect. It's nothing to do with punishment here, like the Hindus may believe. It's cause and effect. The absence of limbs is an effect of that drinking and smoking. No one's being punished here. It's cause and effect. But look, those physical actions of the parents had an effect on the future generation. Medicine today even has proven that the child that is born in an environment where there's a lot of sound pollution, and the mother, for example, is stressed during the 9 months of gestation because of sound pollution, there's a higher probability that the child will be born with a stronger preponderance towards being or experiencing stress. Look, this is a mental thing that happened with the parents, but the consequences go to the offspring. And then we have spiritual actions. Now here, this is outside the realm of modern medicine. There, it's not within their domain to give an opinion on, when it comes to spirituality. But we believe that in our spiritual deeds too, how you think, how you earn, how you act, all these have an effect on future generations. Is it fair on the newborn? No, it's not fair. But who are you attributing the unfairness to? To Allah, God forbid? Attribute to the parents, the great-grandparents, and so on and so forth. Yes, when it comes to judgment day, everyone will be judged accordingly. Many of the faults that apparently we attribute to that offspring, someone else will suffer because they were the cause, be it the parents, grandparents, and so on and so forth. So this abavah, yes, that can be, and it may have a number of specific applications, masadir. We don't have to limit it to the genetic parents. And genetic parents, usually in the Quran, the term waladain is used, not abawain. And even when Nabi Adam and Lady Hawa is mentioned, they mentioned the abawain is used there. And there are many secrets to that, another time inshallah. But the esoteric understanding of this verse is this, that even a Muslim who gives born to a Muslim newborn, that Muslim parent can lead that offspring to become Jewish, Christian, or Zoroastrian. And we don't have to limit it to those three. They were the three main belief systems, but we can go further. The Muslim parent can make the Muslim newborn Hindu, Buddhist. And this has many connotations, even socio-political connotations. We'll come one by one later. And we have many traditions that support this. And I'll go into the specific examples tomorrow. But those who were able to go for Hajj, but they missed it intentionally, the ahadith describe that they'll be given the choice. Do you want to be with the Jews or the Christians in the hereafter? They'll be resurrected as a Jew or a Christian. Or there are some traditions where people, Muslims, they speak of them being resurrected partially as mushrik because of their either doctrinal or jurisprudential or ethical behavior. So there's no room for complacency. God knows how we're going to be resurrected. And inshallah, I'll continue with this tomorrow. Continuing with the poems of Umman Sarmani, which we started last night. Last night was, the question was, what was the whole story of Karbala about? And he tried to answer it. Today, the extracts that I've chosen wants to address this question, that why did Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, allow many in his caravan to leave the scene? It's a question. Why did he give that permission? And he answers it in a very delicate manner. One may also have a question within one's mind that, look, especially after last night's poems, those 72 had a very high status. They even drank from the sediment of the wine. Look. One may say, how come, let's say, Muslim ibn Aqil wasn't part of the 72, for example? Yeah, Muslim ibn Aqil had a very strong status, very strong identity. His iman was untouched. But he wasn't one of the 72. Look, this is following from last night's poems. Look, he at the end of the day, he wasn't one of the 72. You may say that, well, the Imam sent him to Kufa. Okay, that shouldn't be a reason why he shouldn't be part of the 72, though. Some answers that have been given, the question's legitimate. The answers, I'm not saying it's 100%. They're speculation. But speculation based on certain facts. In this journey, Imam said to his followers, whoever is indebted has a debt to pay, leave the caravan. This is not the place for you. And in the story of Muslim, it did become evident that he did have a debt to pay through certain actions. Why am I saying this? It's not to say that Muslim had a lower degree than those 72. That's not the point. But to deserve the status of the 72, the Imam said, if you're indebted, leave. Why should being in debt compromise your presence in the caravan of Hussein alayhi salam? And it's very easy. The Urafa have a very good answer. The Fuqaha, based on fiqhi principles, getting a loan, one Muslim from another, they will say, jayiz, it's permissible. That's based on their principles of fiqh. That's okay. But that same faqih, if they are an arif, even though in the sharia they were to say it's permissible to take a loan, in the tariqah they would say it's impermissible to take a loan. In the tariqah, when they say it's impermissible to take a loan from someone else, it doesn't mean if you take one, you're going to be burnt. It just means you're compromising your spirituality. That perfection is being compromised. Perfection is of degrees. But the degree of perfection of the 72 was very high. Whoever is in debt, leave the caravan. When you take a loan from someone, it is almost impossible for your tawakkul upon Allah not to be compromised. When you take a loan from someone, there's a bit of reliance on that person. Reliance upon Allah becomes compromised, even a bit, even if it's a bit. But there's no room place for compromise when it came to the caravan of Hussein alayhi salam. Whoever is in debt, leave the caravan. The reason I just mentioned this before reading here is we, most of us, have come from the West. Although it's not a question of West or East anymore. The whole system of debts and loans has infiltrated societies. Look. It's killed the soul. It's reached a level that you can't live without those debts. If you are someone who doesn't need a debt, for example, you inherited significantly, and you don't need a debt, it would be poisonous to get a loan for a bigger house or a bigger car. That would be poisonous. It was a blessing for you to do without a loan. Look, when we say Hussein, Hussein every year, every day, sometimes Hussein for us is just like an ornament or something very symbolic. We do everything in the dunya as we want to do to live a free, a burden-free worldly life. And once a year, we go to ziyarat and we say Hussein, Hussein. We've lost the plot. This is definitely American Islam. There's no doubt about it. Where you live your West toxified life, wherever you are, drowned in debt from beginning to end, and we're assuming it's all pure Islamic loans. We're drowned in it in a West toxified manner, but we're very complacent with it, and once a year we go for a ziyarat with utmost disgrace, say Hussein, Hussein, when there's no synchronicity with Hussein alayhi salam. We're hypocrites. This is going to be very bitter. But look, if you want, this is just one example, a loan-free life, maybe then you can taste what those in the caravan of Hussein tasted, and then drink from the sediment. Drinking the sediment of the chalice is not an easy thing. It's difficult. In the many years of tabligh, which I had different places, there were two or three, and either accidentally or for whatever reason, they were convert communities. These two or three small, very small convert communities in different states, two states primarily in America, they had a very pure life. From the time you entered their house, it was very humble. There was no glitter of the dunya in those houses. When you would sit, you wouldn't sit on a luxurious carpet or marble floor. The food they would give was very basic. And it was interesting that they would do everything to avoid getting a loan, from anyone. It was a common feature in those two communities. But they were converts. And they reached this ma'rifah. There were other convert communities too. They hadn't, but these they did. And the whole lifestyle was a lifestyle where if maybe, well, definitely me, if I were to see such a lifestyle, say, what kind of life is this? You can't drink from the sediment with a burden-free lifestyle. Imam said, if you have a loan, leave the caravan. What does this mean? 99.9% of us would definitely not be in the caravan. There's no doubt about it. Why are we fooling ourselves? Look. But in these poems now, in these verses that Umman Salmani reads, he wants to address this question. Why did Imam allow people to leave? Let's go through it. I'll read the Farsi and then the translation. And then there's a very subtle point here. Either we want to benefit from it or not. But we're very complacent. And that's very disturbing. خاند یکسر همراهان خیش را خواست هم بیگانه و هم خیش را. So he called out to his companions all together, called his companions, calling both maybe the non-Hashemites amongst his companions and the Hashemites from Bani Hashem amongst his companions. گفتشان ای مردم دنیا طلب، اهل مصر و کوفه و شام و حلب. He said to them, O people seeking the worldly life, O people of Egypt, Kufa, Sham and Halab, Halab being now, it's always in the news these days, in Syria. مغزتان را شور شهوت غالب است، نفستان جاه و ریاست طالب است. Your mind is filled and predominated by shahwa. Your souls seeking prestige, power, leadership. So this is in relation to a certain part of the companions. If this is the case, leave. But then he addresses another group of the companions. ای اسیران قضا در این سفر، غیر تسلیم و رضا عین المفر. O captives of destiny, in this journey, other than submission and being satisfied before Allah, where is there to flee? همراه ما را هوای خانه نیست، هر که جست از سوختن پروانه نیست. Accompanying us, that feeling of home is no more. Those who are with us truly, there's no sense of ownership. We don't own a house, we don't own a job. None of it was ours. Those who are with us, they don't have a sense of ownership. That feeling of home doesn't apply. We have a duty here. Whoever flees from being burnt is not a moth. Whoever flees from being burnt, from being killed, from being martyred, from being assassinated, they're not a moth. A moth is always attentive to the light, symbolically to Allah. The moth is always attentive to the light, will never lose track of the light until it goes towards it, until it burns, until it dies. Whoever wants to flee from being burned, from being killed, they're not a moth. Look in this one verse, two prerequisites. One, that feeling of home. My house, my job, my everything. Those with us, they don't have that. And you can't escape martyrdom. It seems, I don't know, it's only a theory here, but without martyrdom and without seeking martyrdom, there is no other way. If you want to be in the caravan of Hussein alayhi salam today, you have to seek martyrdom. You shouldn't escape from being killed. For example, now in Syria, why aren't we going there? Especially for the non-Iranians. It's open for you. You can make an effort. Many have gone. What's delaying you? Well, definitely you won't be part of the caravan of Hussein alayhi salam. You're fleeing martyrdom. Right now, the caravan of Hussein has to manifest in Syria. Or before in Iraq too. But martyrdom is the key. If you come here for the seminary studies, and then you go back, and you'll probably deviate after a number of years after returning, normal life, everything the same. But now you're here. The opportunity is for you, ready. But are you seeking it? Now this is very important. These are secrets, really. I mean, you would always hear, for example, the Sayyid in Lebanon always say that the only way is Shahada. You would hear that many times. But what does that mean? Yet the Urafa have touched upon this. Yes, he is right. The only way to be part of the caravan of Hussein is Shahada. In Iran, that revolution, look how many people became shaheed before a true revolution arose. Did it happen in Egypt though? Did it happen in Tunisia, in Libya, in the so-called Arab Spring? What was the difference there? Look. What was the difference? One was leadership. One was the call of leadership. They became shaheed. When you become shaheed, you've guaranteed Islam. And it's the only guarantee you have of yourself. In your life, when you make a decision, if that decision is shahada filik, you're growing. If it is shahada phobic, you're not growing. Stop saying Hussein, Hussein. Don't be a hypocrite. The decisions that you make in your life, are they shahada friendly, making you seek shahada? Or are they shahada phobic? Make that decision. نیست در این راه غیر از تیر و تیغ گو میا هر کس ز جان دارد دریغ. In this journey, in this way, there lies nothing but swords and arrows. Tell them not to come in the caravan of Hussein. Tell them not to come. Anyone who is unwilling to give their life. Look, you can't be more explicit. These are the secrets of Karbala. These are the secrets that we have to incorporate in our lives, not just once a year on a ziyarah, and then return to that worldly, West-toxified life of ours. For some reason, we people, we've been brought to Qom. Look, that's half the way. A part of us will go back to that West toxified lifestyle, and we will deviate slowly but surely. a part of us will go back to that West Oxford life and do their duty of tabligh to the best of their degree, which is okay and necessary. But a part of us from here will go towards Shahada. Wallah, that's the most important if you want to be Husseini. Let's not play with words now. This is the message of Karbala. But we've been drowned now with the matams and the poems and the songs and the nasheeds and this and that. So much so that the main essence of the story has been totally lost. جای پا باید به سر بشتافتن نیست شرط را رو برتافتن. One must rush with one's head instead of feet. When you want to seek martyrdom, you have to go there with your head first, quickly, not walking. Rush with your heads. Going back on the way, turning back, and we'll speak more about this in future nights, is not an etiquette to consider. هر که بیرونی بود از مجلس گریخت. رشته الفت ز همراهان گسیخت. All these applied then, but it applies today too, to the Hussein of the time. Whoever was not one of us, a Husseini, left the assembly. He left because they weren't qualified. The thread of affinity from the true companions got cut. It can be cut today. We're cut from that thread of that affinity. دور شد از شکرستانش مگس و از گلستان مرادش خار و خس. The fly became distanced, became cut off from the imam's sugar cane. The thorns and twigs got distanced from the garden of imam's pure ones. خلوت از اقیار شد پرداخته و از رقیبان خانه خالی ساخته. Solitude from all other than Allah, from all else, was finalized. Those who left had left, and now the pure ones remained. From the non-purified companions, the Imam discharged them from the abode. پیر میخاران به صدر اندر نشست، احتیاط خانه کرد و در ببست. So the mentor of the wine drinkers, the leader of the wine drinkers, sat at the helm and acted with precaution and shut the door. So now no one who wasn't qualified, they don't enter. محرمان راز خود را خواند پیش، جمله را بنشاند به پیرامون خیش. He called upon those akin, familiar, those akin to the secrets around oneself, sitting them all down around himself. با لب خود گوششان انباز کرد، در ز صندوق حقیقت باز کرد. With his lips he entered into partnership with their ears, in close coordination, his lips and their ears. Those not qualified, they couldn't hear. Opening up the chest of secrets of حقیقه. جمله را کرد از شراب عشق مست، یادشان آورد آن عهد الست. He intoxicated them all through the wine of love, reminding them of the pledge of Alast. That pledge of Alasto Berabbikon in that semi-immaterial realm before Allah's knowledge. He reminded them of them, their pledge they gave there. Goft shabash in dile azadetan. Bade khordastid bada yadetan. He said, bravo, how fortunate are those free hearts of yours. You freed it from everything. You had drunk wine. May you recall it, inshallah. May you recall that realm. Yadetan bad, ay bedeltan shure me, on esharatay saqi peyze pey. Recall, O you whose hearts are yearning for the wine, the secrets of the cupbearer, one after the other. Inak az har gushe, ay jam ghafi. Mar shoma ra mizanad saqi safir. Now, from every corner, O congregation, the cupbearer is calling you. He's saying to those 72. Kin khumar an bade ra bud dar ghafa. Han u han an va'de ra bayad vafa. That this being killed is an after effect of the wine. Beware, you must abide by the promise you gave. گوش چشمی می نماید گاه گاه سوی مستان می کند خوش خوش نگاه. The Imam was observing them from the corner of his eyes from time to time, observing the intoxicated ones rejoicingly. Is the Imam seeing us today with rejoice or not? It's very easy. You have to evaluate yourself. وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين.